This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The world audience seems mesmerized by an American president breaking things. But most countries seem on the verge of collapse, with political turmoil, if not outright civil war. The stock and banking scene is just surreal. Perhaps you are sailing through life, never been better, but I'm sure you sense the great dis-ease. Or maybe you are already busy cleaning up after the latest weather disaster. We are just entering shift time, when the weather gets wilder, new bugs and bacteria appear, while old species fade away. In society and on the planet generally, everything is moving away from the center and toward the poles. It's hard to get the news and science of climate change out through that state of crisis, but we are going to try because this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith.
Radio EcoShock.
Terrorism, elections, Trump. Does anyone remember the real narrative of this century? You know, the minor detail that a shift in climate will disrupt everything and everyone. Let's talk about some of the disturbing signs from around the world that suggest the big change is already underway. We are joined by our regular Radio EcoShock guest, Paul H. Beckwith. Paul teaches climate science at the University of Ottawa. And you now lecture at a second institution as well, Paul?
Yes, I've been teaching also at Carleton University in the geography department.
Well, that's good. You need something to do because I know you have tons of time on your hands with all your YouTube that you make and your many media interviews. I know you've been busy after the Ottawa storm, you were telling me.
Yes. After the Ottawa flooding, I appeared on a number of different CBC programs, both TV and radio. And then once your name is out there as a person to talk about this, then other media organizations contact you, like Radio Canada and all these different newspapers and things like that. So, you know, a bit of mainstream press to get the message out there about abrupt climate change.
You're definitely an out there guy, but why did you go storm chasing in the United States?
Well, last year was the first year I went. So meteorologist friend of mine and I, we just decided to go out to Tornado Alley. And last year we didn't see any tornadoes. We saw everything but tornadoes. And this year was pretty much the same story. He was keeping track of something called CAPE, which is convective available potential energy. So it's sort of how much energy is in the atmosphere. And we've got good models and good data showing what it will be like sort of days out, you know, a week out. And then you get closer to the day, it's revised and you get better data. So it looked like there was going to be lots of tornadoes in the U.S. So we went down and we drove down from Ottawa and we were there for 5 days this time. We saw all kinds of crazy storms and we saw funnel clouds, but no tornadoes. A funnel cloud has to touch the ground in order to be a tornado. So we saw some structure developing under some of the storms, but no tornado. So they're harder to spot than one might think.
I have heard a lot of storm news every night on the major U.S. networks. It's just a regular feature now with tornadoes and floods and big hail, the works. Is that the new normal?
This year has been very unusual because we have this jet stream configuration where it follows the Greek letter omega. Basically, the crest of the jet stream is in the central part of North America, and the trough is in BC and in Quebec and Ontario on the east coast. So the trough on the east and west coasts are low-pressure areas leading to huge amounts of rain, torrential rains, and the resulting flooding that we've both seen on both sides of the continent. So this pattern is just kind of stuck there, and it's still ongoing. It's still happening. And, of course, the oceans are very warm. So there's a source for water vapor, and that water vapor is coming ashore and forming the clouds and these large storms. Where is the middle part of the continent? If you look at Fort McMurray, you know, Winnipeg, you know, all those areas in the mid part of the continent are having 30 plus degrees Celsius clear weather, no rain. And in fact, this is a concern in Fort McMurray because we know what happened there with the fires just last year.
Yeah, an oil sands country. Look, let's skip across the world. Bangladesh has just come through a major typhoon, and that's not unusual, but they do keep coming. And meanwhile, the U.S. East Coast has almost forgotten big hurricanes in the last couple of years. Is the science settled on whether we will see more storms or more violent storms as the world climate heats up?
I think it's pretty clear. There's a pretty clear picture emerging. The extreme weather events, like torrential rains leading to flooding from massive storms, you know, the size of the storms and the duration of the storms and the intensity of the storms is increasing. It just makes sense that, I mean, for every degree Celsius rise in temperature, there's 7% more water vapor in the atmosphere. That's just basic physics of evaporation. And with more water vapor in the atmosphere, that water vapor rises and it fuels these storms. It produces, we measure it with this CAPE that I was talking about, the convective available potential energy. And this energy, it's from the phase transition from water vapor as it condenses into droplets. The energy is released. The latent heat of the water vapor is released to the atmosphere, and it causes the motion. It causes the high wind, and of course we get the rotation activity and tornadoes spinning off and these large storms. So there were more storms expected than we saw when I went down to the U.S. Generally, when you get tornadoes, they can be at the leading edge of a storm front if you've got warm air moving over cold air, rising, producing the convection. So you get a line of sort of a frontal storm. You can also have these storms popping up and then combining, creating supercells. And these are more sort of sporadic or isolated storms where you can get tornadoes spinning off. But what happened is there was so much energy in the atmosphere, you know, it just started raining pretty much everywhere, widespread. So the energy from, you know, that rainfall, you know, then quenched some of the energy in the atmosphere. But the statistics has changed. Under our new climate, you know, we're seeing a lot of instability, and the statistics has completely changed. So, you know, a 1-in-100-year storm event is no longer happening 1-in-100 years. It's happening maybe every decade. And actually, Trudeau even stated this. He said it would happen every decade or even every few years. I think he misquoted me when he said every few years. But that was just a day or two after I'd had a bunch of CBC interviews talking about that very thing with 1-in-100-year storms. So yeah, the statistics has changed. So we're seeing a lot more of these storms. And you know, there's also shifts. So as it gets warmer, you know, with the jet stream changing location, it's very possible that what it used to be or is currently called Tornado Alley in the U.S., that can actually move northward. You know, if the cold air from the Arctic now meets warm air, creating that clash of air masses and the high storm activity, that can actually shift up into Canada. It's been interesting that we've seen a number of different tornadoes in Alberta recently. And also, they've had a lot in Russia. And I checked the latitude of some of these cities, and they're 53, 54 degrees latitude north. So they're actually quite far north for tornado. Generally, you think of them as a warmer area event.
You know, while you're away storm chasing, it wasn't a tornado, but at least 10 people were killed in Moscow by a very strange storm that toppled trees right across the city. And that's where most of the deaths happened. People in their cars were hit by trees.
Yes, this wasn't tornadoes. Yeah, as you said, this was straight line winds. This was very, very fast winds. One term that can be used to describe these is derechos or derechos, where they can travel, maintain strength sort of in a line of storms, you know, over large distances. As there's a big clash of cold air and warm air, it's a cold front, and then the cold air is lifting up the warm air, and the water vapor in the warm air is condensing out into the clouds, fueling the storm front. So the winds over Moscow, with winds, there's a very strong threshold. The damage to structures and trees, etc., it goes as a velocity cubed of the wind. So you'll have a wind of a certain level, depending on how strong the infrastructure is, and absolutely nothing happens. Everything's fine. Some stuff gets blown around. You know, increase the wind speed 10 kilometers an hour. You can cross this threshold, and the damage, because, it, you know, 10% would be 1.1, bring it to the third power, you know, and a significant amount of energy in that storm, which will then cause widespread damage everywhere. So that threshold was just reached in Moscow and caused all that damage that you were talking about.
I want to move to some headlines about extreme heat, and from the term global warming, we expect to experience more extreme heat events. This past month was loaded with them in many parts of the world. One killer was on May 28th in the Pakistani city of Turbat. It was the hottest day ever recorded in Pakistani history, and that's saying something. Paul, it was 53.5 degrees C or 128 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade. That'd be pretty hard to take, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, when we start getting temperatures like that, people can't be outside really for any length of time. Also, of course, the humidity is very important. So I don't know if people remember some of the things we've talked about in the past with wet bulb temperature. So if you have 100% humidity and 35 degrees Celsius, then the body is not able to get rid of heat. You're not able to sweat. And core temperature just goes up, and you can start being susceptible to heat stroke and even, you know, dying if you're out in the heat for, half a day, sort of with that type of temperature. So when we're talking about 53 degrees Celsius, I actually saw
In Iran's eastern Sistan region, temperature an astounding 56 degrees C or 132 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, I mean, these sort of temperatures are extremely scary. How can people survive with these type of temperatures?
And making it worse, Paul, the demand for electricity there broke the power and the water system, so the people had really no way to cope. And that's happening now. How does it look for 2050 if we keep polluting as usual?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, right now we're seeing, you know, a day here, you know, maybe a series of a few days up to a week with those sort of temperatures. But what happens when we have those temperatures, you know, all summer for months on end? And, you know, the temperatures don't drop at night either. And that's very harmful to people when they, you know, if they don't have access to air conditioning. So guess who? All the people that die are people that can't afford air conditioning, and the people that survive are the people that have it. And, you know, of course, if the power goes out, then everybody's on an equal playing field. Everybody's at risk if they have no cool place to go to. So, yeah, I mean, this is becoming a huge problem. Like, I don't understand what it will take for governments and for the public to demand, you know, strong action on climate change. You know, some governments are going the wrong way, of course.
I think when the economic costs come in, as they did just recently in Bangladesh, there was a headline from late May, panic in Bangladesh factories as workers collapse in the heat wave. Hundreds of workers fell sick, were taken to hospitals. The factories that make clothes for us shut down. So maybe with economic costs hitting, that's why so many big American companies warned Trump not to withdraw from the Paris Agreement.
Yeah, there was something like 95 of some of the largest companies in the U.S. were on board with the Paris Accord and wanted it continued. And we should really say it was the U.S. federal government, or we should say it was the Trump government that, you know, has climate deniers throughout the administration, and they don't listen to the advice of the military. They don't listen to the, I think there was something like 4 of every 5 Americans wanted to stay in the agreement, in the Paris Accord. And there's hundreds of cities in the U.S. already have said that they will stay in the agreement. They will try to meet the emission targets that are within the agreement. There's the states of California, New York, and Washington all have Democratic governors, and they formed a U.S. climate alliance of states that will stay within the Paris Accord. And I think that the state of Massachusetts, which has a Republican governor, has joined with them. And already with these 4 states, I think there's a few more that we're talking about, you know, maybe 50, 60 million people, you know, living within those states, which is already a decent fraction. And this is only, you know, it was only last Thursday that the announcement to get out of the Paris Agreement was made by the U.S. Federal government. So, and of course, the global pushback has been, very sharp and very severe, with many countries saying that they will strengthen or redouble their efforts to reduce emissions to meet the Paris Accord. And, you know, even there's two other countries that aren't in the accord. So 195 countries signed the agreement, two didn't. The two that didn't are Syria and Nicaragua. Nicaragua didn't because they thought the Paris Agreement wasn't strong enough. So the U.S. has joined them, and Nicaragua is not happy with this. They said that they may have to go and sign, even though they think the agreement isn't strong enough.
So, that would leave the U.S. with Syria, and those are good people to be with, I'm sure. You're listening to the weekly Radio EcoShock show as broadcast around the world. I'm your host, Alex Smith, and with me today is Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. Well, let's get to something that you really specialized in, and that's the Arctic. I was reading a post on Reddit, and someone unofficially was saying that researchers Natalia Shakova and Igor Samilyatov will soon release a paper reporting Siberian methane releases are way up to 8 times higher than before. Have you heard anything about that?
I've just heard about the same things that you've mentioned. I don't have any details on that. I do know that there's been a number of different papers recently that are recording. Basically, one paper was reporting on finds of many different crater features on the seafloor in the Arctic.
I'm going to speak to that scientist.
And there was another paper that was talking about mounds in the Arctic, these mounds up to 500 meters in diameter that are most likely thought to be precursors to these craters. So if there's methane hydrates that are thawing underneath, of course the volume expands 160 times as the methane hydrate thaws, and then that methane pressure builds up, and then it can blow out a crater. And those sort of hills or mounds on the seafloor are thought to be, they're slightly deeper than where the craters are found. So the water's a bit colder, they haven't thawed. But, you know, they could basically pop very soon. And how much methane would be released from one of those craters? Probably quite a bit. So, yeah, I think this is a very important paper that will come out, because the world really needs to recognize that climate change is not a linear process.
The worry is that a big release of methane could trigger a relatively sudden warming event because of the huge power of methane versus carbon dioxide as a global warming gas.
Yes, exactly. And it's also in the Arctic. And in the Arctic, there's a lot less of the hydroxide in the atmosphere, which is a scavenger and reacts with the methane and takes it out of the air. So the Arctic, you know, of course, it's a lot colder, it's drier there, so methane that stays up there has a much longer lifetime than the mean lifetime of 12 years, whereas methane at the equator has a much shorter lifetime than 12 years because there's a huge amount of water vapor there from evaporation, you know, the high heat evaporation of the seawater. So the methane lifetime on average is 12 years, but in the Arctic it will be a lot longer. So then the question is how long will it stay up there? You know, how long will it take to diffuse to lower latitudes? And that does take some time, because things tend to be contained up there somewhat by the jet streams.
So inside Climate News reports, Alaska sea ice is melting unusually early. How is the Arctic sea ice doing, Paul?
Well, the Arctic sea ice is far below previous years. It's record low for this time of year, in terms of the area, in terms of the extent and the volume. You know, of course, the volume is the most critical thing. Most of the ice, you know, from year to year, the amount of 1 year sea ice, basically very young sea ice, it doesn't survive a summer melt season. Okay, so it's formed in the winter and then it melts out in the summer. So that's like when we talk about multi-year ice, it's generally ice that's 2 years or 3 years or, you know, 5 years old. Of course, the older the ice is, the stronger it is, because over time, the brine pockets that are within the ice work their way through the ice. They're pulled down by gravity and they just leave the bottom of the ice. So the ice that's left is purer and purer and fresher the older it is. And it's stronger. That makes it stronger. So young ice has a lot of brine pockets, a lot of inclusions, a lot of fractures and things, and it's a lot weaker. So the ice that is in the Arctic, we're losing most of the multi-year ice. It's just the first-year ice that's left. So it's a lot weaker, and it's a lot more susceptible to melting out in the summers. So the ice, will it set a new record in 2017? The probability of that is very high, but you know, it depends a lot on weather conditions, local weather conditions in the Arctic. How it depends on whether conditions are favorable for exporting a lot of the sea ice out of the Fram Strait between Greenland and Svalbard. It also depends on how much warm seawater is coming in from the both the Atlantic and the Pacific sides. So there's lots of factors, so we don't know for sure, but we do know that the probability of it completely vanishing in a summer is increasing year to year. I still think it's very likely that we're going to have complete loss of sea ice in a September by 2020.
Now, NASA just announced a new way Greenland is melting. Please let me read you the introductory paragraph from the NASA press release. It says, a new NASA study finds that during Greenland's hottest summers on record, 2010 and 2012, the ice in Rink Glacier on the island's west coast didn't just melt faster than usual, it slid through the glacier's interior in a gigantic wave, like a warmed freezer pop sliding out of its plastic casing. The wave persisted for 4 months, with ice from upstream continuing to move down to replace the missing mass for at least 4 more months. Paul, that doesn't sound very good.
And I bet that when this was reported, it was, this is unexpected. We're losing ice faster than expected, and this is a complete shock. I mean, I think it's time that scientists, you know, sort of wrap themselves on the head with a mallet and say, you know, look, the expectations are wrong. Like, you can't just keep telling the public every paper that things are happening faster than expected. You know, try to expand your thinking, and, you know, you need to change your expectations, right, to the reality of how quickly things are happening. So this is another perfect example. I mean, every time we get a new paper on melt rates from Greenland and Antarctica, you know, there's new phenomena that are uncovered that greatly increase the rate of melting and therefore the expected rate of sea level rise. So we then notch that up, you know, and this happens year in, year out on a continuous basis. So why is this happening? It's because so many of the expectations are based on computer models instead of based on looking at trends that are happening on the ground, you know, measurements that are on the ground of how quickly sea ice is declining, whether it be volume, extent, or area, how quickly greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere are rising. I mean, we just had over 3 parts per million rise in 2016, also in 2015, whereas the IEA, International Energy Agency, says that human emissions have been flat, you know, somewhat in the last 3 or 4 years. Well, they're certainly not flat levels in the atmosphere, and that's what climate cares about. So we're at the end of the rope. We don't have time to mess around. And, you know, so this is why the Paris Agreement was so important. It went nowhere far enough to maintaining that 2 degree or 1.5 degree above pre-industrial targets, but it got 195 countries to sign up, and with mechanisms to ramp up actions as required, which is required now.
We've talked about heat, about storms, and about the Arctic and ice. But 10 years ago, a prominent scientist told me on radio, Alex, it's not just the warming. Watch out for big changes to the hydrological cycle. You've touched on that. Recent news, seldom reported in the West, talks about 200 dead after heavy monsoon rains, floods, and mudslides in Sri Lanka. Now, here's the incredible part. They got 12 months' worth of rain in just 24 hours following a period of long drought. Your comments?
Yeah, they had no luck in the climate casino, basically. I mean, what I mean by that is, you know, I've also used the terms weather whiplashing or weather wilding. We're seeing regions go from one enormous extreme long-term drought, for example, to torrential rains in a short period of time. And this can all be related back. When you hear of things like that, just go on to Earth Null School or Google Climate Reanalyzer and go on to those, either of those sites or both of them, and have a look at what the jet streams are doing, and you'll see that the jet streams are behaving very strange and unusual, and they're very, with very sharp ridges and very, you know, intense troughs, and they're staying over a particular region, and they're leading to these sort of torrential rains. So, you know, Sri Lanka, yes, we've seen this also, I believe, in Lima, Peru.
And Taiwan.
And Taiwan. You know, we've had all of these events in, you know, in Canada. We've had for April, we had 150 millimeters of rain in Ottawa, which was, we would normally get about 65 or something millimeters of rain. So, you know, 2.5 times higher. In May, the first week of May, we had almost 120 millimeters of rain in Ottawa in the first week. And we would normally have about 70 millimeters for the entire month. And of course, you know, the ground saturated, the water runs into the rivers, and we had massive flooding for houses and cottages. Anybody living or having a structure along the Ottawa River or the Gatineau River. Lake Ontario has just been, the water from Lake Ontario has set record levels. A few years ago, it was at record low levels, and now it's at record high levels. And I took a boat trip around the Thousand Islands from Gatineau, Ontario. And, you know, as you go around, this was a couple of weeks ago, it's worse now. But there's many cottagers flooded out. There's many docks flooded, boathouses, you know, the actual cottage structure with huge damages. And I haven't seen any numbers for that. So all of these things are really ramping up. These extreme weather events are ramping up, and they have huge economic costs. They put a lot of people into poverty. Like, they really hollow out. If you have a cottage on, say, the Ottawa River, you know, and the structure was destroyed by the flooding, you know, may not be covered by insurance or flood relief. So you basically lose, you know, you have a huge financial loss. So, you know, it really takes down people a notch. If it's somebody's house and there's no insurance and they're in poverty, you were talking about the Bangladesh, right? The typhoon. I mean, they evacuated 1 million people. You know, there were people that were at least 500,000 to 1 million, I heard. And these people just had to leave. And when they come back, some of the islands and things on the rivers that people were living on, well, the islands were completely destroyed and moved. I mean, they're basically sandbars on a river. So these people would just have to start from scratch again. So how do you ever get yourself out of poverty if these events are forcing you to move?
Hundreds of millions of people, according to New Science, may simply have to leave the country that they've known for centuries or thousands of years. I've just interviewed the French scientist Gilles Ramstein. He has a new paper coming out in PNAS explaining how speed up of Greenland ice melting, which we've talked about, will devastate agriculture in the band of North Africa called the Sahel. And their paper, Paul, actually says that a food failure by the end of this century, if we keep going with business as usual, climate, could spur tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of Africans to just force them right out of their countries. We've just seen a big surge of African migrants to Europe, challenging the politics there and society. Hundreds of millions is unimaginable on our current course. Are we heading towards unimaginable human immigration or human migration, let's say?
Yes, we're on a clear path to that very thing happening. And I think more and more people are starting to recognize that, I mean, this. when do you call something an emergency? I mean, if you're in a theater and you smell smoke, well, maybe it's the person smoking illegally. A few rows from you, you know, you don't yell fire. You don't raise the alarm. But if smoke starts coming in from the ceiling or the doors or something, you know, you pull the alarm, it's an emergency, you're out. Well, I mean, we're well into that emergency with climate change, but you know, nobody's I mean, scientists are trying to pull the alarm, some of them, that are connecting all the dots, but, you know, others aren't. And policymakers, you know, will have their conference and they'll talk, and it's like they have all the time in the world. They make their policy decisions. You know, governments aren't taking strong enough action. Like, nobody is treating this as a climate emergency yet. And this is part of this is human nature. You know, we wait till our backs are against the wall and then we take action. So once we take, you know, once the planet, humanity, recognizes the terrible risk that we all face, the climate emergency that is playing out around us, then, you know, maybe, you know, I guess we can hope that governments will start taking very, very decisive and strong action to address the issue.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We continue our conversation with Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa.
And of course, what does that mean? What does that strong action mean? I mean, I've talked about it quite a bit. It's slashing fossil fuel emissions much faster than we're doing. It's removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and it's cooling the Arctic using technologies that we have a good understanding of, enough to know that they will actually work and cool the planet somewhat. There's all kinds of other ideas. You know, can we restore sea ice in the Arctic to make sure the Arctic stays light, that it reflects a lot of sunlight and stays cooler so the jet streams can somewhat restabilize? There's techniques to capture vast amounts of carbon by putting these buoyant flakes, rice, you know, based flakes full of nutrients into the ocean, so they float around and they generate huge phytoplankton growth, which and then subsequent growth of zooplankton and other fish. You know, we get a restoration of the food chain, and that also pulls out a lot of CO2 from the oceans. Right now we're making things worse.
Well, we're trying, Paul, and we're not just sitting and waiting for the climate apocalypse. We're trying to get the word out there. You are an uncommon climate scientist. You basically expanded your university classroom to the whole world through YouTube, and your Facebook page is a lively feed that I often visit. How do people find your work?
Generally, you know, I get favorable comments. I mean, there's always going to be, you know, comments. You know, people have lots of different ideas as to how to solve issues and lots of different ideas as to, you know, the way that the climate system will play out. Because one of the big questions that is always there is, okay, so what's going to happen within 5 years? What's going to happen within 10 years? So, yeah, I mean, I go on these phases where, you know, I'll do like a video every day for weeks. You know, and then, you know, with my storm chasing and with some other work that I've been doing, I was actually doing a number of videos on the Ottawa flooding, because I think there's a large human component in the actual flooding that took place in the Saturday, May 5th or 6th, whichever day is the Saturday. There was a very rapid rise of water in Ottawa of almost a foot in 2.5 hours, and it spiked. The water spiked up, and that's not a natural thing that's going to happen, even though heavy rainfall was happening. So there was water that was in a northern reservoir that was dumped, and that water pulse came down and spiked the water in Ottawa. So this is, I don't see this as anything other than human negligence or human error, and it hasn't been out there in the news at all. I went up to the reservoirs and interviewed some people. You know, I've been caught in some of these other little projects. I'll get back to doing a lot more videos, but I've had, since the Ottawa flooding, and I've had a tremendous number of requests from CBC News, CBC Ottawa, Radio Canada. Today I was just on this, I was on the Business News Network live, which is part of CTV, I guess, and I've never had much traction with mainstream news outlets until about a month ago with the Ottawa flooding. And then since then, I've been kind of barraged with interviews and stuff. So I've been doing those, and that's taken away time from me doing the videos. But I'll get back to the videos. I enjoy doing these videos. I'll probably end up filming some either later tonight or, you know, in the next few days.
And folks, you can find those at paulbeckwith.net. And we could talk for hours, Paul, and I enjoy talking with you. Maybe someday we should do a climate marathon.
I think we should. We should just go until you can divide it up into, you know, part one, part two, and just go till we've, you know, exhausted everything we want to say. And, you know, people can listen or not, right, if they have the time.
Yep, we'll think about that one. I'm going to post links to all these climate news stories that we've talked about and some more that we didn't get to, the science, Paul's work, all in my own show blog at ecoshock.net. But don't forget to track the latest at paulbeckwith.net. Thanks again, Paul, for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Yes, well, thank you, Alex. It's always a pleasure talking with you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In the last few years, the public was captivated by the sudden appearance of large craters in Siberia. Scientists suggested these were mounds called pingos containing methane, which then erupted. They blew up. Now there is a flurry of new science finding the sea around the Arctic is pockmarked with big craters, as large as half a mile across or 0.8 kilometers. There are also undersea mounds which contain methane. Are they a danger to shipping? Can they be drilled and captured as an energy source? As the climate warms the seas, will these undersea pingos blow out a new wave of methane to warm the planet even more? I have a lot of questions. Fortunately, we have as our guest one of the bright young minds in the field. Pavel Serov is working on his PhD at the Norwegian Research Institute called CAGE. That is the Center for Arctic Gas, Hydrate, Environment, and Climate at the University of Tromsø in Norway. Even as he studied in 2015, Pavel Serov already published an important paper on subsea methane activities in the South Kara Sea. That was in the Journal of Geophysical Research. Now he has a new paper in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. From Norway, Pavel Serov, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi.
Okay, before we get to the science behind your new paper, why do you think there is so much interest now in seabed methane in the Arctic?
Well, we know that Arctic, same as the rest of the world, is experiencing increase in temperatures. And the Arctic is getting warmer and warmer, and the process of warming in the Arctic is much, much faster than in the rest of the world. So that is why there is a big attention to processes happening in the Arctic Ocean nowadays.
I've been looking at several new papers about undersea mounds containing methane and hundreds of craters, and I see four interlocking motives for the drive to study this phenomenon. And Pavel, I would like to run each of these ideas by you for your comments. The first is a quest for pure science. We want to know what we don't know, and we want to complete a geologic history of that area. Is that part of your work?
Yeah, it is definitely a big part of what I'm doing.
A second motive has been suggested, namely the need to predict the risk of energy exploration in the Arctic, and perhaps even the safety of ships crossing the Arctic Sea as an alternative route to and from Asia. Pavel, can eruptions from undersea mounds be a danger to shipping?
Yes, I've heard this question before. But unfortunately, we cannot really even predict the scenario when the ship will ever sink due to ebullition of methane gas from the seafloor. In theory, it is possible. There have been few episodes when oil companies drilled through the gas pockets, and then the gas bubbles, well, basically decreased the buoyancy of the water column, and then it triggered some consequences to the drilling vessels. But nothing dramatic happened. None of those vessels or drilling platform sank. So far, this phenomenon have never been observed. If it can be observed in the future, well, we don't know. But from my perspective, it seems highly unlikely, first of all, because amounts of methane stored in one particular place, in one particular gas pocket, is not sufficient to significantly decrease buoyancy of any vessel.
Well, that's good. A third possibility is a desire to find more energy resources. Pavel, are corporations or countries interested in tapping into the methane that is trapped under the sea?
Yeah, there is a certain interest from oil and gas companies in extracting gas, extracting methane gas from gas hydrates. And there have been quite a substantial advances in that. Yeah, I've heard that Chinese and Japanese companies managed to produce some methane gas from subsea gas hydrate reservoirs. So far, it's just the first attempt to do that. So we don't know if it's going to be, the future of the oil companies or not. But we know for sure that technologies now exist. So extraction of methane or other hydrocarbon gases from gas hydrates is possible.
And a fourth motivation is to assess the risk of more methane reaching the atmosphere, which could increase global warming. What do you think about this?
Well, yes, of course. But to me, it seems like there is no big difference between what exact methane is being combusted or what exact methane is being used as an energy source. It doesn't matter if it's coming from gas hydrates or if it's coming from terrestrial or offshore gas reservoirs. I mean, if it reaches the atmosphere, it has exactly the same global warming potential. So the source of the methane is not such a substantial question to be answered.
Now, Pavel Serov, let's look at your science, beginning with the 2015 paper. The title was Methane Release from Pingo-like Features Across the South Kara Sea Shelf, an Area of Thawing Offshore Permafrost. I suppose we should start with the idea of what is a pingo?
Yeah, what we call pinga is a mound. Mound composed of some soils or bottom sediments, if it's a subsea mound. And also those mounds incorporate some solids. Often they incorporate permafrost, so it's a frozen ground. But in some cases, as we, for example, observe in the Barents Sea, they can also contain some gas hydrates. So basically it's a seabed structure or land structure, a positive structure that has something solid inside.
Are the pingos that exploded on land and captured quite a bit of attention in Siberia when these craters formed, are those the same as the structures that you were studying under the seabed?
Yes, they think they might be the same. The structures we've discovered in the South Kara Sea, they also related to permafrost, but it's not on-land permafrost, it's so-called subsea permafrost. In fact, it's the same. It's just frozen soils and the bottom sediments. But the difference is that they're covered with a water column. So what we think we've discovered in the South Kara Sea is a mound that eventually might develop to a crater when the mound collapses.
Could you explain to us a little bit about the geologic and climate history of the area you studied so that we can understand why something that was once land is now the seabed? How did that happen?
Yeah, during the glaciation, the last glacial maximum in this part of Eurasia was approximately 22,000-23,000 years ago. Substantial amount of water was incorporated in ice sheets. So during that time, there was less water in the world ocean, meaning that the sea level was much, much lower than it is today. So some of the areas that are now covered with water were land 20,000 years ago. So those lands, those terrestrial areas, were subjected to very cold atmosphere. And of course, the ground, get frozen. So that is why we have permafrost in those areas.
What is the source of the methane in the mounds? Does it come from a geologic process, or is it a byproduct of microbial life?
Yeah, according to our analysis, according to geochemical analysis of methane, we think that it's microbial gas. So it's recently produced gas in a shallow part of sediment or soils.
Yes, that paper goes against the conventional wisdom about the origins of this methane. I think a lot of people thought that it was ancient, but now you say it's more recent. How do you know that?
Well, what typically is called ancient methane is thermogenic methane, methane that has been formed deep inside the sediment sections, somewhere at 2-3 kilometers deep, perhaps. So that's the gas that oil companies usually use, explore. Microbial gas is something, in theory, microbial gas can also be very, very old. But since it forms at very shallow parts of the sediment section, it tends to escape very rapidly I mean, it's not covered by any thick sediments, any thick strata. So it migrates very quickly from sediments to the water column and then potentially to the atmosphere. So when we see some microbial gas involved in any kind of process on the seabed, we presume that it's a relatively young gas.
And how concentrated was the methane in the two mounds that you studied in the South Kara Sea?
If compared to the background concentrations of methane or the concentrations of methane in surrounding areas, the Spingos, those mounds, contained up to 1,000 times higher methane concentrations.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest has become an expert on undersea methane in the Arctic. He's Pavel Serov. And that methane may be a new frontier of science, a new energy source, or a grave danger to the climate. Well, now we turn to your latest new work as a lead author, just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy. The title is Post-Glacial Response of Arctic Ocean Gas Hydrates to Climate Amelioration. Pavel, that sounds like the climate motivation is very strong in this paper.
Yeah, indeed. The climate motivation is strong. We think that the mounds discovered in the Barents Sea, close to Svalbard Archipelago, could be potentially, well, underestimated sources of methane, at least to the water column. What is also interesting is that natural climatic variability drove to formation of those mounds something around 14,000 to 12,000 years ago. So development of these structures is closely linked to natural climatic variability.
Yes, your research shows large amounts of methane were released after several deglaciation periods, including the Heinrich event. Could a very rapid melt in Greenland now stimulate an undersea release of methane, including perhaps explosions?
Well, yeah, if the Greenland continues to melt, some areas where subglacial gas hydrates can be stored nowadays might start releasing methane. It's very hard to make any prognosis on that. I mean, Greenland is melting. We know that it's melting quite rapidly, but we don't know what's going to happen next year or in 5 or 10 years. We don't even know how the atmospheric temperatures are going to change. So we can hardly make any predictions of when and if it's really going to happen in the future. I mean, when and if such mounds can form in Greenland. But there is still a possibility.
Something you said is quite key. You said that the methane is released into the water column. Do we know how much of methane that seeps out of the ocean beds is actually reaching the atmosphere?
Yes, it is a very good and hot question. Now, at the water depth where those mounds were discovered, it's approximately 380 meters. Almost none of the methane gets to the atmosphere. Because we know that within this thick water column, there is plenty of microorganisms that oxidize methane to CO2. So the methane flux from the sediments gets substantially reduced in the water column. However, we know that there are several sites where the exchange of methane from sea surface to the atmosphere is recorded. It's mostly very shallow sites where the travel time of methane bubbles from the sediments to the sea surface is very short. It means that it has less time for methane oxidation. It means that it has higher potential for being transported to the atmosphere.
In an email, you wrote that the release of more seabed methane is not triggered by surface warming, which I assume includes the abnormally hot, low ice summers of recent years in the Arctic. Tell us about what the real trigger is.
We think that the real trigger is changes of temperature on the bottom. And it's not directly connected to, at least not at this water depth, not directly connected to the increase in sea surface temperature, simply because this thermal wave does not propagate that deep in the water column. But what does matter is the bottom water circulation. We now know that this area, the area where the gas hydrate mounds are, is highly affected by West Spitsbergen current. It's relatively warm current bringing water similar to what Gulf Stream actually brings to the northern hemisphere. So it's warm and relatively salty water. So if those water masses change, if they become warmer, it might destabilize gas hydrates on the seafloor or close to the seafloor.
Where else have scientists found this methane mound phenomenon in the sea? How about Canada, for example?
In Canada, there is several locations where gas hydrate pingas were mapped, but those locations are mostly within subsea permafrost regions. So it's a quite similar scenario to what we have seen in the South Kara Sea.
And you're currently working at the Norwegian project called CAGE. Another CAGE scientist, Karen Andreessen, just published a new paper in the journal Science on June 2nd. How does that paper relate to your research?
We think that these two papers actually come together. In the paper about the craters, she says, or we think, that the craters form as, when methane hydrates destabilized on the seafloor, which caused substantial release of free gas into the sediments, and then it caused overpressure and eventual blowout. However, what was before the blowout itself, we think that something similar to gas hydrate pingas was formed on the seafloor. And that's exactly what we're observing now at another location in the Barents Sea, at Storfjordene. So the story, the paper about pingas, is actually a description of the process that is probably one step behind the formation of the craters. So these two articles is basically a description of two steps of one process.
Is the research for these papers funded in St. Petersburg or by the Norwegians?
It is funded by the Norwegians. It is fully funded by CAGE, Center of Excellence for Gas Hydrates.
Pavel, we can't avoid the internet of people who worry that the Arctic will become a source of masses of methane, which could overwhelm our climate system. These include scientists in the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, or AMEG. Are you really concerned more methane will come out of the northern seas as the climate warms?
Yes, the area of them, well, of the major concern is area where this subsea permafrost is distributed. Those seas are very shallow, and as I mentioned previously, those areas are very, well, they're very prone to thermal influence from the atmosphere. They can warm very fast, and they can release a lot of methane. Also, since the shallow water depth, or due to the shallow water depth, the methane released from the sediments can easily be reaching the sea surface and can potentially be transported to the atmosphere. So shallow permafrost areas are of the biggest concern nowadays.
What do you think of the work of Dr. Natalia Shakova and Professor Semilyatov of Tomsk Polytechnical University? Both of them have been guests on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, I'm familiar with their works on the East Siberian shelf. We all cite those publications now. We don't know if it's really the case when during storm events more methane is being transported to the atmosphere. We think it is a possible scenario. However, what we also think that this hypothesis has to be tested in many other locations. It has to be tested in different weather conditions in different times of year. So the theory has to be proven.
As you said, the Japanese have mounted an exploration ship to try capturing undersea methane from the frozen form known as clathrates. China as well. Do you think Russia or Norway are interested in seabed methane as a commercial energy source?
I honestly don't think that Russia and Norway are really interested in methane hydrates as a commercial source, just because both countries have quite a lot of so-called conventional deposits of both oil and gas. And those conventional deposits are so much easier to explore, and I guess they're so much more profitable than gas hydrate deposits.
Now, is the size and shape of these undersea structures determined by the methane within them? Are they sort of like mounds with a bubble of frozen gas lifting the seafloor? What determines the shapes that you're finding?
We don't know yet, but we only can guess now. Well, our best guess is that methane flux largely regulates the shape and the size of the structures. So the diameter of the structures is regulated by the size of the permeable zone in sediments along which free gas migrates and along which gas hydrates are being formed.
Scientists have found undersea pingos in many parts of the Arctic Ocean, as you've said. Does anyone know if there are similar structures around Antarctica, or does a different geological history there in the South Polar seabed make this less likely?
We think that the structures like this might be discovered in Antarctica as well. unfortunately, there is much less data coming from Antarctica. It's much more remote. It's much more difficult to work there. As far as I know, there is only a few locations where seabed methane release have been mapped before. So there is very few data. We cannot say if it's possible or not yet. But we presume that if we have much more data, we would find something like craters or possibly gas hydrate pingas, because the geological evolution was definitely not a factor that would allow us to rule out the formation of craters or pingas. It's quite similar to what's going on in the Arctic.
Where do you think this research into Arctic methane under the sea is leading? What still needs to be done here?
We're definitely sure that drilling is needed, because with our tools nowadays, we can only see what's going on in very shallow sediments. So, we can only recover 2, 3, 4 meters of sediment sections. If I had an ability to go deeper, we'll definitely tell more stories, and we'll be able to look at much older times. So that's essential.
You know, I've talked to scientists who say, why spend money going to Mars? We already have a new frontier that we need to explore, and that is the seabed, with all the resources and the things that science can discover there.
Well, this is true. We still have a lot of unknown places. We still have a lot of areas to explore. Yeah, even in the Arctic. And, of course, Antarctic region is comparatively unexplored areas, and there is plenty of other locations where we would like to go. So, yeah, there is a long list of things to do in the ocean as well. Well, I'm not saying that it's not worth going to Mars.
Well, finally, I want to know, can you assure our listeners that warming seas will not lead to a serious or even catastrophic release of methane in the Arctic? Do we know the answer to that question yet?
We definitely know that not so much of methane will reach the atmosphere. We do know that if we continue increasing global temperatures, we would probably increase the input of methane to the world ocean. There is one risk connected to it. We don't really know how much capacity of reworking those methane emissions the world ocean has. If it's limited or not, we don't know yet.
We've been talking with a young scientist already publishing research in top journals. He's from the Faculty of Geology at St. Petersburg State University in Russia. But Pavel Serov is currently at Center for Arctic Gas, Hydrate, Environment, and Climate at the University of Tromsø in Norway. The new paper, just out from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, is titled Postglacial Response of Arctic Ocean Gas Hydrates to Climatic Amelioration. It's by a group of scientists from Norwegian universities and from the Centre of Glaciology in Wales, UK. Our guest, Pavel Serov, is the lead author. Pavel, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you.
It may sound like Pavel Serov is not concerned about methane coming from the Arctic seafloor. He says methane that may blow out from the deep mounds he is studying, some 380 meters or 1,200 feet deep, should be absorbed by the microbiotic life in the water column, although the oceans may have a limit to how much methane it can process. At that depth, hotter surface waters have no real impact. Only a change in circulation at the bottom affects these clathrates. But that is in the deeper waters around the Norwegian Arctic. It's a different story in the shallow seabeds in eastern Siberia. Surface heating can affect the frozen seabed there, and that acts like a cap to the methane below. Some will be released. There are bubbles of methane measured arriving at the surface and going into the atmosphere. Scientists are still trying to determine how much. Almost separate from all this is the theory raised by Natalia Shakova from the University of Alaska and Igor Samilyatov from Tomsk in Russia. They suggest that an undersea landslide could release a burp of methane up to 50 megatons, almost like a methane bomb. That alone could push up the Arctic temperatures, and possibly global temperatures, for a period up to about 10 years. Such an event would stimulate other feedbacks like melting permafrost, which could continue for centuries. But as our guest Pavel Serov says, this is still a theory under investigation. Others say it is like waiting for an earthquake. It may happen, but when? In the next 10 years or the next 300 years? Out of all this, there is a pretty clear picture that in the past deglaciation events, and we're in one now, large amounts of methane were released from a frozen state in the sea. These releases added warming and may have created an abrupt shift of climate. Some scientists suggest that melting clathrates alone brought about catastrophic climate change and a new age. For now, it's difficult to know how much methane will emerge from the seabed in our lifetimes and how fast. Scientists at the Norwegian Institute CAGE, Russian institutes, the Chinese and the Japanese are all working to find those answers. I'll continue to report on this issue as it develops. Radio EcoShock is dedicated to bringing you the hard truth from around the world. Thank you for listening again this week.